Well, for the tape, I think we can go ahead and get started. This session is entitled Cystic Fibrosis, Genetic Cures, and Questions. And my name is Cheryl Ney. Since they're a small group here, we can make it as conversational as possible. So please feel free to stop me at any point. I've chosen as my focus for the week something called the HGI Project, which is the Human Genome Initiative. That's a $3 billion, 15-year, federally funded project, which means that your tax dollars are supporting it. And the goal of the project is to do what's called sequence the human DNA. DNA, you remember, is that molecule important for both heredity and for normal cell function. So the project promises to have a profound impact on the world, particularly in the area of genetics. I chose cystic fibrosis today because it's one of the genetic diseases that is being focused on a lot. It's in the press a lot. I don't know if you are following it all or you've seen stories, but it's really one of the hot topics these days in the world of genetic diseases. We can take it as an example of other genetic disorders. All right, so I want to update you on this one, and then we can use it as an example of other things. And what I'd like to do today is I tell you the story of what's happening with cystic fibrosis. If you could pick out the issues that you see are going to arise for society or parents or you as a taxpaying citizen or what have you, if we could pick those issues out together, I think that would be interesting. So that's your job, is to keep track of the issues. I'll just provide the information here. We've been talking now for a week and a half about how science really offers us both benefits and risks, and I think genetics promises to be one of those areas where the risks may be very great if we're not very careful. So that's why I've chosen this topic in terms of science. Cystic fibrosis is one of about 3,500 characterized genetic disorders. So science understands, at least, that there are approximately 3,500 at this point disorders that can be traced to some kind of genetic origin. You may remember in our discussion of DNA yesterday that what happens with cell function is that you need DNA to be your blueprint to make your proteins, and your proteins are what carry out the work of the cell. Remember, the proteins are the housewives or workhorses, depending on your metaphor, for cell function. So what happens in genetic disorders is something has gone wrong with the DNA, so therefore something has gone wrong with the protein, so therefore the cell can't function normally. And that going wrong with the DNA can be as simple as, if we took this to be DNA, which remember is a very long molecule made out of building blocks, this going wrong with the DNA can be as simple as replacing an orange bead for a purple bead. So if we know that orange needs to be here and we replace a purple for an orange, that could be enough to cause serious malfunction with the protein. So what that tells us is that our DNA is very precious and we have to be very careful with it. Just as an aside, I guess, people have done some studies now to show that one thing that cigarette smoke does is it has a molecule in it which ultimately interacts with your DNA. So that's where the problems are coming from. So love your DNA. That's the moral of that story. What's interesting about cystic fibrosis is it's one of the most common genetic disorders among white Americans. All right? It's a common genetic disorder among white Americans. It's estimated that 12 million people carry one copy of the bad gene for cystic fibrosis. And if you're a carrier, apparently, in this disorder, there's no noticeable effect. But what that means is if you marry somebody who's also a carrier, then you have a 1 in 4 chance of producing a child that has 2 copies of the bad gene. So it takes 2 copies of a bad gene in order to produce a full-blown genetic disorder. So 12 million people in this country are estimated to be carriers. 30,000 people are estimated to have 2 copies and therefore have the full-blown disease, and it's estimated that 500 people die every year of cystic fibrosis. Now, I'd like to give a little perspective to that data, because very often you have that information in an article that starts something like this. So I'd like to provide perspective, but usually you hear something like this. This is an article from Maclean's magazine in Canada, which says, "The Fight for Life." The irrepressible joy of childhood all but masks the disease that is threatening six-year-old Ashley Dyer. The happy, outgoing girl who lives with her parents and infant brother was born with cystic fibrosis, a hereditary respiratory disorder that usually kills its victims before they reach the age of 30. So that's usually how stories start when they want to provide you with this information. I'd like to just put a little perspective on this. I just said that 500 people die every year from this disorder. I happen to know, because it sticks in my brain, that 40,000 children die every day on this planet because they don't have clean water. 40,000 children every day.
Because so they don't have what?
Clean water.
This is in the world.
All right. Another piece of perspective to add on this is that very often being a carrier for a disorder, that is having one bad copy, can give you some positive advantage in life. So for example, another disorder, sickle cell anemia, I don't know if you're familiar with that disorder, that's a disorder that commonly afflicts people in certain regions of Africa and other Mediterranean-type countries. In the States, it's commonly thought of as an African-American disorder, but it's also prevalent in the white population, which many people don't understand. Sickle cell. What happens is your blood cells sickle. So normally blood cells are round and look like donuts. In sickle cell anemia, because of a one bead change here, the cells sickle and then they clump together.
Right.
So what happens is they clog capillaries.
Okay, so it affects your circulation.
It affects your circulation. Yeah. But if you have one copy of this disorder, it helps people survive malaria. Because malaria is a parasite that grows in blood cells. So if you have one copy, a certain number of your red blood cells are weakened and thereby kill the parasite. So having one copy is not necessarily a bad thing. It could be in the case of cystic fibrosis that we don't necessarily understand what the positive advantage is for that one copy in cystic fibrosis. So I think those are two important ideas to keep in mind when you're presented with statistics like that. Too often we forget that having one copy may allow you some kind of survival advantage. And let me just say another thing about sickle cell anemia. As I said, it's predominantly found in people from Africa and Mediterranean countries. And the exact problem with the DNA has been known for 40 years now. In the early 50s, people knew what the problem was with the DNA for sickle cell anemia. No one has tried to develop gene therapy for sickle cell anemia. So I think that's an important thing to keep in mind because the push is on cystic fibrosis right now, which, remember, affects predominantly white Americans. All right, so there's another piece of information that I think is useful to know. Are you all familiar with cystic fibrosis? You know the problems. It starts as a respiratory disease, but what happens then is you end up getting digestive problems because the passages are clogged, and then it just moves into other organs, and it essentially wears a person out, wears their system out, so they die at a very young age. In the last 10 years, the lifespan has improved considerably. It's moved from teens to 30s by treatment. So you may be familiar with one of the treatment strategies, and that is you have to constantly pat the back of both the back and the chest of the child several times a day, because what you're trying to do is keep that mucus from building up, which clogs arteries. Also, apparently there are you can provide nutrient-rich diets, you can give enzyme supplements and antibiotics to keep infections down. So the treatment has improved considerably. Also right now, there are lots of new drugs that are coming out that are being tried on a trial basis. So the treatment is improving dramatically in this disorder, which also I think is something important to keep into perspective as we talk about fixing that DNA. People now understand exactly what the problem is at the molecular level for cystic fibrosis, and that is because of the work in genetics. So genetics has allowed people to understand that what happens is there's a protein, right? Remember, proteins do the work. There's a protein which is supposed to pump sodium out of your cells. All right, your cells have to maintain a certain level of sodium. And what happens in cystic fibrosis is that the pump is not working. And so the cells accumulate lots of sodium. They have lots of chlorine in there. So essentially, the cells are jam-packed with salt. And salt, as you may or may not realize, just mops up water. So what's happening is all the normal fluid that cells would have is being sucked up into the sodium chloride. And that's how all the mucus builds up and what have you. All right, so I don't know how many animal lovers we have out there, but rats and mice have been dying at a profound rate here for this, for these studies. What they do is they put the good copy of a gene on a virus. It's the cold virus. And they disarm the cold virus so it won't give you a cold plus give you a good copy. So they somehow have to, they genetically engineer the cold virus that's got this good copy on it. And then they use an aerosol spray so that this good copy with this virus carrier gets into lung cells. And what they have found now is that those lung cells will produce a good copy of the protein. And that good copy of the protein takes care of the starts to take care of the problem. The problem is that lung cells apparently die every 6 months, every 6 weeks, so you have to keep on giving this spray. And they've only done one round with the rats and mice. So they don't know what will happen if they spray, you know, at 6 weeks intervals. So there's a lot of work yet to be done on the animal level. And then, of course, you'll have to have human subject research.
Is that the gene in the DNA?
Uh-huh.
Okay, so what they're actually doing is putting in some new DNA. Have they broken that right down to the DNA to the gene?
They're not replacing the bad gene yet. All they're doing is, here's your DNA, then they're giving you a spray that brings in this good copy of the DNA. So they're just hoping that if they have enough good copies, it'll produce the protein pump.
Okay, and then my other question before I forgot.
Yeah.
You mentioned that cigarette smoking had an effect on DNA.
Right.
Are there other things that have a beneficial effect as well as other things that have a detrimental effect on DNA?
Uh-huh. I can answer the bad things first. You've heard the word carcinogen, mm-hmm. of course, and many of those carcinogens ultimately end up interacting with the DNA and changing the DNA. So the chemical basis for carcinogenesis is some kind of malfunction with the DNA. Benefits to DNA. Well, there are some people who work in the nuclear power industry who would argue that a small amount of radiation can have a positive effect. But I think the jury is still out on that. Of course, if you work in that industry, you would want to think that it would have a beneficial effect.
Then you're saying your DNA can change in a person.
Yeah.
Like my DNA might not be the same at 60 that it was at 20.
Yeah, yeah, for lots of reasons. There's also some normal things that happen to change DNA, some normal processes. But you being in the environment can change your DNA.
I just thought as people were identifying people by their DNA that it was interchangeable, like your finger.
Uh-huh, right. No, it changes.
But if it changes.
Yeah. It doesn't change dramatically. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you were talking about a fingerprint, maybe one tiny piece of one tiny line changes. You know, they're not significant changes from a fingerprint point of view, but from normal cell function they could be significant changes. Yeah, it just takes, as I said, just takes one change of one bead that could really destroy normal function.
Is it the fact that it's a virus that takes it into the cell?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And they don't know things yet, like what happens if you get a cold and you've been treated with this virus. Does that normal cold virus then influence the mutant cold virus? And then what you get is all kinds of immune problems. So they're still apparently a long way off from, they say they're 2 years away from human trials, but I don't know. One scientist here says, "We now know it works in the test tube and in animals. I can guarantee that we can correct the defective protein in humans." So, I don't know. On the other hand, the same scientist says, I'm sure we could do it safely once, but I'm not sure what would happen the second time. So, I don't know whether...
6 good weeks.
Yeah, 6 good weeks. One of the stories was for just Time Magazine. That story was for Science Magazine. So I don't know whether he changes his tune depending on who he's talking to or what. So I really think we're kind of a long way off still, I hope, in doing some of these things. My basic, I think there's a scientific question to be asked, and that is, when people introduce a gene into an animal, what they're looking for is a specific effect to take place. So what they want to see is that this protein is made in this animal. What they don't look for is other kinds of effects. And certainly when you're dealing with animals, you can't then begin to ask questions like, does the animal's behavior change, for example? So the problem with these animal studies, I think, is that in the long term, we don't look for unexpected changes happening. So I think there's some, I have some scientific questions about these kinds of things. Another question I think that comes in thinking about gene therapy is eventually you're going to have to do some human subject research. So is it going to be your child that you're going to offer up for human subject research? There has already been a 4-year-old child to have gene therapy for another disorder. Do you remember the bubble boy down in Texas? That was a genetic disorder, and they've already are trying it right now, this introducing the gene through a virus on a 4-year-old girl. So I think they're... Exactly. So I think there are always questions to be asked whenever you're doing human subject research. There's some other questions now. What we've done now is to provide a good copy of the gene. Well, if we can do that, maybe we should start thinking about how to take the bad copy and put a new copy in. All right. And if we do that now, are we only going to do that on? When are we going to do that? Are we going to do it on embryos? Are we going to do it in a child? Are we going to do it in an adult? If we decide to do it in embryos, then we have the question of, it turns out that for cystic fibrosis, the males become sterile in this disorder. So then the question is, if you've got a male embryo, I don't know if you can tell at what point an embryo is male or female, but if you're doing it in the embryo, should you do it in cells that are also the germline cells? That is, should you correct it for every future generation thereafter? So I think those are a few more serious questions. These are two terms that you may start to hear. Just the somatic cells means changing it for just that person. But if you want to change it for future generations, then you have to change it for germline there, in the germline. So at the moment, many scientists favor somatic gene therapy, but the people are saying, well, there's a very clear line between somatic and germline therapy. And they're not recommending germline therapy. Just because, again, if you don't know what the beneficial effect is of the one copy, it might not be a good idea to start changing it. That's one.
Well, there's might be side effects with the long term.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. On the other hand, other people say, well, if you know how to do it for somatic, how's that going to stop anybody from doing it germline? So some people say the line is very clear between somatic and germline, but other people say it's a very fuzzy line.
You think if a person already has the bad genes and has the deformity, can they change the genes?
Uh-huh.
Person and put him back to normal?
That's a very good point. It turns out with cystic fibrosis, as the disease progresses, there are things that replacing the gene can't fix. So for some disorders, it's going to be very important to decide at what point to change the gene. So in every case, you won't be able to reverse the progress of the disease. This would be a case where you have to do it very young. This particular disorder. Another thing that's happening now, once you've got this gene, You can do lots of things besides gene therapy, and that would be screening for the gene in the population. And so people are wondering, since 12 million Americans carry this disorder, the gene for this disorder, maybe we should screen the whole population so carriers would know, you know, if they were marrying a carrier, for example. The problem is that this particular disorder, the gene that they've identified, or the most common mistake for this disorder happens in only 85% of the cases. So that what that would mean is that you could only pick up 85% of the people of that 12 million who are carrying that gene. So should you go ahead and screen the whole population knowing that 85% of them, you only pick up 85%? That's a question to consider. And then, of course, whenever you have testing, you have to worry about, well, what happens if it's a false positive? Let's say now we're not screening for, you can screen for carriers, but you can also screen fetuses, for example. So let's have prenatal screening as is done for other kinds of disorders. And this is something you always have to think about when you're screening fetuses. What happens if you have a false positive? Meaning, the test said that the fetus was carrying it, but actually the fetus wasn't carrying it. What's the family to do? I mean, these are really difficult questions. What about a false negative? The test said that the fetus would not develop with it, but they end up having the disorder. So there are all kinds of really, I think, knotty problems when you think about genetic screening. Another problem, which reminds us that all this is happening in a culture, is that many DNA testing labs are not regulated. So you get more false positives and false negatives if a lab is not being carefully regulated. It happens in the state of New York, they regulate pretty heavily, but not in many other states are they regulating labs. The products for the tests are being regulated by the FDA, but the labs themselves are not being regulated. And as some technicians point out, it's real easy to make a mistake, real easy to make a mistake. For some of this testing. So as you go on to screen, of course, you're going to have problems of how you're going to use the information. There's already been cases where insurance companies are dropping people if they carry the cystic fibrosis gene, right, if you've got the gene. You're going to lose your insurance, possibly. Apparently, 20% of the companies in the United States are doing genetic screening for their employees because they're trying to keep their health care costs down. So they're doing genetic screening. As you move on to think about other disorders, there's a screen out now for Huntington's disorder. That's a disorder that has an adult onset. And you have a 50-50 chance of having this disorder if you come from a family with that. So, you know, you could screen at age 20, and maybe you find out you've got this disorder. And there's no cure for it at the moment. And the treatment plan is not very helpful.
But that would give you the option of should you have children.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
Right.
It's very devastating.
It is a very devastating disease. Right. But there are lots of disorders which are not carried. You're right. That is a one positive effect, but then you have to live with the fact that you're going to know that you're going to get this. I don't know which may be better than living with not knowing that you're going to get it. I don't know.
I'm wondering.
Yeah, right. You may change your lifestyle. And of course, another serious problem with screening that's going on now is screening for sex selection. But in India, I think this is a real serious problem where you screen and if you have a female fetus, you undergo an abortion. So screening in and of itself, I think, presents all kinds of serious problems.
Is annual risk, is that genetic screening?
Gosh, I don't know enough about these things. I think there, isn't that, aren't they just testing for AFP?
No, I think they're testing for chromosomes.
Because one of the things they pick up in embryo is chromosomes. That's the big one that they always tell you.
It's also, don't they also do it for spina bifida? That's one where in England they require, that's required.
And are those genetic diseases?
Those are genetic diseases. And with spina bifida, the degree to which you get that disorder varies greatly.
But it's also when you can treat it in utero.
By therapy, gene therapy?
Right. But that's one, that there are certain things that they can pick these up and do something about it, and what they can do.
Generally, what they can do is decide to abort or not.
Yeah, no, but there are some that there can be therapy.
You probably mean treatment, maybe.
Yes.
But not gene therapy. I don't think gene therapy.
See, I don't know. That's what I don't know, is what kind of treatment.
Yeah.
And that's why I was thinking, is it, if amnio was a genetic screening?
Well, I think it probably depends on what you order and what you decide to have tested. Or what you're required by law to have tested. That's really all I have prepared in terms of thinking about cystic fibrosis. Are there particular issues which you'd like to focus on?
Well, is there a difference between chromosomes and genes or DNA?
Genes are part of the chromosomes. With thinking about Down syndrome, what you're looking for there is very large pieces of the chromosome can break off and add to another chromosome. So some disorders come from very large aberrations in chromosomes. But then there's this whole other class of that kind of one bead kind of change.
I'm thinking of lazy Y or lazy X chromosome.
Yeah, is that an extra X or? There's all kinds, as Elizabeth was telling us, there's all kinds of things that can happen, yeah. Yeah, so there's this whole, there's the chromosomal aberration kind of class of genetic disorder, mm-hmm. but then there are these kind where you're just changing one or two of the building blocks. Yeah.
I have a question. I was just thinking, in the lab, do we test for cystic fibrosis sweat, the sweat test?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know why. Do you know
why? Because what's happening is the protein pump that pumps out sodium,
it doesn't
work. And so sodium accumulates in cystic fibrosis.
So that's what they measure, the sodium?
Yeah. But now they have a gene screen for that, so they'll probably be doing less and less.
Yeah, but what?
They can screen for the gene, the defective gene, if it falls within the 85% kind.
So that test is kind of old?
Yeah. I mean, this is real recent stuff.
But it's something that a child who has very salty sweat, then didn't have any other reason, just that you need to do the gene screening.
Right.
That's when the kid is.
Right.
You know. Yeah. Right. My friend has a child with cystic fibrosis in her family, and so her brother had a child who died from cystic fibrosis, so they knew that there was a possibility.
Uh-huh.
And she was not surprised when the test came back positive, because she knew this. And when her child, she said, when she put her tongue on it, tasted salt.
Wow.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Could you maybe say what the impact of that is on the family and the child? And
well, I think it's pretty soon to tell. But one thing that was surprising to me was that one of the parents was very, extremely devastated by it.
Uh-huh.
The other one, whose nephew was going to die, that family is very involved in Cystic Fibrosis Foundation and, in a typical kind of educated middle class way, finding out everything about it. And they were fortunate that the child was born in Wisconsin, which is one of the states that has an early intervention program, which is funded by the state.
Uh-huh.
So this child has had all these kind of, you
prescribing this kind of treatment from the very beginning.
Uh-huh.
It was diagnosed almost immediately.
Uh-huh.
But I think partly the early diagnosis in many ways is very hard on them because there was not much time of thinking the baby was all right.
Uh-huh.
But I mean, that's always an issue.
Uh-huh.
You know, is it better to know right away
uh-huh.
or to wait?
Uh-huh.
And other friends of ours who have a child with Downs, they very interesting. The chaplain came to them in the hospital and said, the first thing you have to do is grieve for the child you've got in hand, and then get on with the child you do.
Right.
And they didn't have very long thinking about their children.
Uh-huh.
And I think they were surprised. It's cystic fibrosis, isn't it? Well, sickle cell anemia is in certain populations, so too cystic fibrosis is in certain populations, and the mother is Jewish
uh-huh.
and the father was not.
Uh-huh.
And so I think they probably got their chance to be good that they wouldn't.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. How old is that machine? I mean, the determine the protein?
A couple of years. It hasn't been long at all.
Are there places in the United States which are genetic centers where they do genetic testing more so than other places, or where would you go?
I think in like large metropolitan areas, you have children's hospitals. Mm-hmm. Very often, there are very strong genetic centers in those large kinds of children's hospitals. It's my impression. Also, I think university hospitals probably would be more likely to be able to do genetic screening.
Are there any diseases that are receiving much attention in cystic
fibrosis? Yeah, the muscular dystrophy genes they're working on. Let's see, what was the surprise? There was something surprising they found out about that gene. I forget. But it's not it's certainly not every gene not every disorder they're working on. They're only
picking the disorder.
I don't think it's a very careful. It's not a careful decision. It's whoever is the strongest lobbying voice for money for federal funds, or
so it's not the one that's easiest to fix, or the one that is most prevalent. And
whoever is the better grant.
Whoever is the better grant writer, or whoever has the better connections with the various foundations that are for people who are disabled with certain disorders.
I'm curious why you presented Sister Pat. Are you connected with her?
No, it's just that they're working fast and furiously on gene therapy for this one.
Well, it's really sick to think about issues.
Yeah.
Although you're only giving us information, you could give us a hint about what you think some of the issues are.
Right.
And that's good. I mean, that's one of them.
Sure.
Which things get looked at, and why something that only kills 5 million people is getting this much attention in something like AIDS, which is killing more than 500 people, isn't getting
right.
And which might be addressed by means that are less ethically questionable. I don't know that.
Uh-huh.
But it seems like drug therapy is mostly what they're doing for AIDS.
Uh-huh.
And this is genetic therapy.
Uh-huh.
And we're more accustomed to drug therapy. And if you have this question about messing around with genes, moves from messing around with one person's genes to messing around with the gene line.
Right.
Nothing else, the effects of making a mistake are so frightening. If you get it right, well, okay, one might have questions about that, but if you get it wrong, what does that mean?
Right.
There's just a whole bunch of questions that, which I think are all attached to, or they all come up when you're faced with the option of doing some kind of diagnostic test.
Uh-huh.
Because then you think, well, what will we do with this information?
Right.
What will you do if you know that this are true? Are you going to do therapy? Are you going to accept it? Are you going to abort? What will you do?
Right.
And some people find that reassuring to be able to find out ahead of time. And others, not. I don't think that there's a real easy
clear-cut answer
about that.
Right. And maybe even a more difficult problem is, what are other people going to do with that information?
Right.
That, you know, it may be fine for you to choose or not to choose to get that information, but
right.
Once the information is there, you know, with insurance companies and employers and, you know, who knows that, who else?
Well, and if one of the responses to positive tests for disorders might be to abort, given how controversial abortion is, that puts them in a really difficult position, because at least now, if how you find out is amnio, it's so far into term that most people will have told everyone they're
pregnant.
Yeah. And then this becomes a very public thing.
Yeah.
Sometimes when abortion is not an option, they choose not to test. The other thing, we have diseases that in the history of man come and go. Like AIDS, 20 years ago, there was no such word.
Right.
There was no such disease. And now we have it. I'm just wondering if this has to do with something changing in the DNA structure that has allowed this to proceed on human beings, just like years ago they had the black plague, which was caused by various things. But diseases have, in mankind, have come and gone.
Yeah. It's probably a bit trickier with genetic diseases, because if you change one of those beads, remember there's 3 billion in your human DNA. So if you change one, the probability that something freaky happening to change it back is probably really, really low. So with genetic disorders, they're generally around for a long, long time, I would think.
So AIDS is not considered a genetic disorder?
No. Mm-mm. At least not from what we can tell so far.
Cheryl, when you say that having one copy of the DNA may have a positive effect, examples of acetylmalacia occurs where there are originally, seems to occur where there's malaria.
Right.
Malaria of danger. That suggests, however, that there's some kind of evolutionary mutation that's going on there. That, it's just very curious to me. I don't know what the implications are. But does that mean that when that ceases to be
useful,
that it becomes more frequent that the disease occurs? That doesn't make sense. I'm trying to do the logic of that. If having sickle cell anemia helps you survive malaria, helps you to survive malaria, it also means that more and more people will have one copy.
Right. So eventually,
the likelihood of someone having sickle cell anemia grows. So then, instead of dying from malaria, sickle cell anemia fails.
Yeah.
So it's sort of postponing or dying from something else.
Right. Yeah. Well, that's over the very long term, I think. Mm-hmm. I don't think people have studied human genetics long enough to know what the ultimate effect is on the population.
Mm-hmm.
Although they are, I'm sure they've studied it in organisms, but I don't know. In fruit flies, I know.
I was just thinking about, you're saying who's in charge of the money and who studies what. Well, now that there's a woman in charge of the National Institute of Health, there's going to be a whole lot of women studying.
We hope.
And they all said, well, it'll take too long. And she said, no, I want it done in a year. So it'll be interesting to see what happens.
We hope.
Yeah, Cheryl.
Yeah.
Money was granted for the HGI.
Yeah.
And so their goal is to unravel.
Right.
Then what? I mean, so now you've done that.
Yeah.
Has anybody thought of the next step? Say, okay, I mean, it's like they put the puzzle together, and so what do you have? You have a pretty picture.
Right.
All pieces in a row. And then when you walk away from it? We're going to do that because now we're going to.
Yeah, no, their rationale is, first of all,
they are going to cure diseases, so they already
Right.
At this point?
Right, exactly.
Okay. So that's not, we're not questioning. I mean, we can question.
We can question. They're not questioning.
Whether or not they're going to do gene therapy.
They're not questioning. Some of them are questioning whether or not to do it in somatic cells or in germline cells.
So they're going to do it.
But they're going to do it.
Okay. Even though maybe mistakes have been made, it's probably genetics.
Yeah.
Are we going to have an option? I mean, none of the rules have been written at this point, right? Whether it's optional, whether it's identity, that's all untraveled.
Right, right. And what they say is, you know, as we work on this, society needs to figure out how they want to use the knowledge. Well, we don't have any precedent at all for society getting prepared to use scientific knowledge. I mean, we have no precedent for that.
We don't have any.
No, huh?
It seems to me one of the things to point out precisely is that our misconception of how medicine works.
Uh huh.
That most of us assume that doctors know what they're doing. And by and large, it's worked most of the time.
Right.
No. And so you try and guess, and he may or may not be right, and sometimes the thing that's done doesn't do what you expect.
Right.
Or there's something wrong that you can't do anything about. So there's a sort of debunking process.
Right.
That's usually, debunking that's usually hidden from us.
Right.
That we usually don't want to see. When I go to the doctor, I would like my doctor to say to me, this is what's going to happen. If I give you this antibiotic, this is going to be the
right. Right, right, right.
But I had this experience recently after I had a cesarean section and they gave me pain medicine.
Yeah.
And it's awful pain, it's really hurt.
Yeah.
And I called the emergency room, I talked to the doctor on call, you know, and she said, well, I can't figure out why you would have that.
Mm-hmm.
No, you can come in, but it sounds really weird to me. And so I said, well, so it hurts. And then after a couple of days, I talked to the nurse and said, I don't know, if it was me, I think I complained.
Yeah.
So I went to the doctor, she changed my pain medicine.
Yeah.
Oh, well, then it was great. But now here's the really interesting part. She gave me samples of a pain, different pain medication. Those were great. She gave me a prescription for that pain
uh-huh.
medication. I went to the pharmacy and they said, your insurance does not pay for that.
Uh-huh.
They pay for this, which is the same active agent in a different carrier,
mm-hmm.
and it didn't work nearly as well.
Huh. Huh.
I mean, it's so there are all these weird things that are going on.
Mm-hmm.
One, that the original pain medication
didn't work,
was
supposed to work.
Mm-hmm. Didn't work. And I said, well, why is that I'm having this pain? And she said, well, you know, when she doesn't do the surgery, so somebody else can do the surgery. But some docs close this way and some close that way. And most of them close the first way, which is sewing these two muscle things together that aren't usually together. But this one doc doesn't do it, and I said, why? Because that doesn't hurt as much. So I'm starting to be convinced that he's right.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so this decision is made about which things to sew together.
Uh-huh.
Because it's sewed together a certain way, it hurts.
Uh-huh.
At least it hurts me,
uh-huh.
it doesn't hurt everybody.
Uh-huh.
This pain medication is supposed to work, it doesn't work, so you get a different activation.
Uh-huh.
It doesn't, but it doesn't work in
uh-huh.
this... whatever it is that carries it, but
uh-huh.
my insurance company won't pay for the one that works. But all these places along
uh-huh.
the way where medicine isn't, to use the word in quotation, isn't scientific.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
It's an art,
uh-huh.
which it's really interesting
uh-huh.
to me to put this dramatic thing against these
your experience,
things,
right.
yeah, which is
right.
much less dramatic and
right.
not life-threatening, although it's certainly hard enough. After enough bad things happened,
yeah.
that, you know, I did think, you think I'm going to die?
Yeah, right.
No, this is not going to go, what a feel like.
Yeah, right, right.
Well, the medical field has in a way kind of kept us in the dark about treatment, about disease, about many things. I mean, we're just supposed to take their word for
right.
whatever happens. But I think now more and more people are taking responsibilities for their bodies and are insisting on finding out what is going on, getting information probably from a pharmacist rather than a doctor, because a doctor can't keep up on the medications and the interaction of drugs and wanting this information and being responsible, more responsible for themselves rather than allowing a doctor to
Well, a little bit of background I heard in the lab, it's amazing how often a doctor will prescribe a broad spectrum antibiotic because it covers their rear, in other words, they're protected. it might not work, but it most of the time will work. And, but if it doesn't work, it means that the person who's taking that antibody, it's not good for them. I mean, because the more antibiotics you take, their body doesn't work eventually. In other words, the antibody doesn't work on you eventually. It's not really smart to mess around with antibiotics a lot. But that's what they do. They prescribe broad spectrum in hoping, instead of waiting for the lab sample comes back, they want to get started right away. So they just prescribe a broad spectrum one. And 9 times out of 10, I guess it works, but it's not. It's not, they're not thinking about the person. I don't think.
Of course, maybe they are. Maybe they may be, because when I have an infection, I want to start now. Don't wait 3 days
for
the test to come back. I want results.
Yeah, what if it's wrong? What if it's wrong?
If it's 9 times out of 10, it's going to be right. I'm not going to be,
you don't care.
I might be better in 3 days. And if it's the wrong one, then in 3 days you use the right one.
No, I don't like to do that many. I don't know.
It depends on what the infection is. On all of it, I think
it seems to me that all of this discussion just emphasizes precisely that these things happen in a culture. And that in some cultures we might be more willing to wait. And most of us in our culture, to be sick for 3 days,
it's not acceptable.
It's not acceptable. We don't have time to be. I know, mm-hmm. I'm a teacher. If I'm sick for 3 days, I have to still teach. It's not like if you're working in a secretarial pool and somebody else does your typing. If I don't go, the class doesn't meet, we get behind. Oh, my colleagues think that I'm a wimp, I'm not doing my job, I'm getting tenure, I don't have a job because I didn't take a broad spectrum antibiotic. Well. That's overly dramatic, but it's only an exaggeration. Right. It's not a fabrication.
I think all of this questioning the medical profession maybe explains why this particular project is so sexy, because since they believe that DNA is the place where everything starts, and DNA makes the RNA, makes the proteins, you know, this looks really easy. If we could just fix the DNA, then we'll fix all these problems, we will get rid of all this pain.
Cure all, so to speak.
Just about like aspirin.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Just take an aspirin. There's a little in one of the doctor's office that says, take two, and then take two before you get up and call me in the morning. Before you wake up.
This is interesting, being able to get a little more insight into something like this, because when we just hear of it and are only able to read maybe one or two, it gives us a very narrow view of this type of thing.
Yeah. Well, the press is all for this kind of stuff. And that's you know, part of it is the amount of pain that families who have children who have genetic disorders have to go through. That the problem is the system that we live in doesn't support families who have kids who are disabled. Does not support at all. And so, you know, it's really attractive to think about, you know, eliminating this kind of pain and stuff. So the press is all positive, really.
Well,
primarily positive.
I would expect also that the success that we've had with the immunizations, although it's not the same process, suggests to us that we can make progress.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you think how unlike it is that a child is born today with enough polio, where what was the last major outbreak of polio was 1955.
Mm-hmm.
That's my whole lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
I have one older cousin who had polio, but that was a devastating disease. It was terribly frightening. Really dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
And so we think, well, look, we got rid of polio, we got rid of the measles, we got rid of all of those things. It gives us an optimistic view that, yes, we can get rid of things.
Mm-hmm.
And particularly those of us who don't have a very sophisticated understanding of the difference between whatever it is that you do to get rid of
polio and this particular.
And whatever you could do to get rid of cystic fibrosis.
Yeah.
So what's the problem with that? I mean, it's very cost-effective to do the polio vaccine, and that was a great breakthrough. But is it going to be cost-effective to do the genetic engineering? I mean, who can afford that? You know, I mean, even in the state of Oregon, with our central, we're looking at having to prioritize medical care, because there are funds for transplants for living with liver, and so we have to look at that. And now they're recommending hepatitis vaccines, at least.
said for the use of toilets for all newborn babies, whether or not they're at risk for hepatitis. And I think it's really very important to know that the Pediatric Society, American Pediatric Society, as well as the American Academy of Family Physicians have come out and said, excuse us, but who's going to pay for three immunizations when you're only going to be getting a very, very, very small section of society who is going to benefit from that, because there aren't, but a very small percentage of people who are going to be exposed to having had hepatitis B when they're born. So even though it's been recommended, you know, those academies backed away and said, no, we're not going to do this until more studies are done to see how it's going to get paid for and how it's going to be affecting the mother. And so it's going to take a lot of courageous decisions, because there's only so much money to spend on projects.
When in Oregon, when they're thinking about prioritizing which diseases are they're supporting, are they also thinking about how to support the people who get to the bottom of the list? That is, are they thinking about how to provide emotional support? And?
Yeah, no, no, it's in the allocation of the healthcare dollar. And what's happened is, they're not going to get funded. They're just simply not going to get funded. There aren't, it isn't passed. No, it's of course, it has to be approved by the federal government to have state initiatives like that, because that's where the funding is going to be coming from.
Federal government.
No. Part of the state, but part of the federal too, because a lot of it is obviously the welfare dollar, and that comes from the federal government.
Well, our hour is up. It really passed quickly, didn't it? Believe it or not, there are still more issues to be considered when we talk about genetic therapy. So that's the next session, is a longer list of issues. And boy, is that electric can opener whizzing fast in this case. Thank you.
Thank you.
It's very scary.